Our second case for today is 02-1003 Brian Baumeister v. Automated Products, Inc. And schedule what I have is 15 minutes for Attorney Stumbaugh representing Brian Baumeister, 10 minutes for Mr. Lockenberg representing Amicus. This was seated time. It was the Anthony Academy of Trial Lawyers. 30 minutes for Anthony Varda representing Edward Solner, and then Mr. Stumbaugh, you've got 5 minutes for the party. You may proceed. Thank you.
Thank you. Justices, may it please the court and counsel. My name is Christopher Stumbaugh, and for the past 7 years, I've represented Brian Baumeister and Jeff Brown with respect to the horrific accident in which they were involved. I am going to be arguing the merits of our case today. Lynn Loffenberg from the Wisconsin Academy of Trial Lawyers will deal with the issues related to Section 895.23 of the Frivolous Appeals Statute. I will be, as the court indicated, handling the rebuttal. This case had its fundamental problem in severe errors by the trial court. The problem was the trial court's approach. When the trial court indicated, not once but twice, that the purpose of summary judgment is to have a trial on affidavits. The first affidavit in the first motion for summary judgment was by Kenneth Buttrey, PE, professor of engineering at the University of Wisconsin-Fifield. He was a structural engineer. His affidavit meets all the requirements that are needed to defeat summary judgment. He shows the review of the file, the review of information from the plaintiffs. He computer modeled the trusses. He further based his opinion on the affidavits of Mr. Solar and Mr. Mann.
Counselor, is that the 2001 affidavit that you're talking about?
Yes, I am. Okay. It's Exhibit 62, Justice.
Okay.
It dealt with several of these issues, and based on the review, it's his professional opinion that the probable cause of the collapse of the trusses was inadequate bracing of the walls. The walls. Then, due to an allegation by Mr. Solner that they did not receive notice of the first summary judgment, in which case the plaintiffs were victors. We acquiesced to the vacation of that order and allowed this to go forward again so that he might have a right of appeal, being the gentleman that we are. We acquiesced. But what happened in the second hearing, Record 120, on summary judgment, was frankly unbelievable to us. We have the trial court deciding the factual cause of the incident. We have the trial court passing on the credibility of expert affidavits and basing decisions not on what was in the record, but in fact, arguments of counsel. We then asked for reconsideration. Within 2 days after that hearing, we filed the second affidavit on February 14th. I believe the first hearing was February 12th. We filed the second affidavit of Professor Petri on the 14th because Judge Galloway asked my associate, Scott Winston, you know, what do you have to say about this?
Counsel, please stand in front of the microphone because it's being recorded.
Okay, thank you. He asked him, he said, Professor Butcher would opine that even if these individuals had followed the Trust Plate Institute guidelines, which are part of Wisconsin law, because they are part of the administrative code and have been adopted as such, even if they would have followed this, our expert would opine that it would not have been relevant in the cause of the collapse because our testimony has been consistent from the very beginning of our expert's testimony that the cause of the collapse was adequate bracing of the walls, not the trusses on which they sat. And this has resulted in a tremendous amount of confusion in this case with respect to what the Truss Plate Institute guidelines call for. The history of this case provides a roadmap to how all this went wrong. But what also happened in the Court of Appeals was they applied the wrong standard with respect to the David Sissel, applying this as an architectural malpractice level, where a structural engineer is under the same ability to testify under Roberts versus State. We don't look at what someone's title is. We look at what their qualifications are and what their ability is. In fact, the principal case relied on by Solar, Vanasek, or Vanasek, I don't know how to pronounce that name, involved an architect, the claims of negligence against an architect, where most all the testimony was by structural engineers.
Counselor, I want to go to that affidavit, which I have before me, the May 2001 affidavit.
Yes.
And it does opine that the probable cause of the collapse was due to inadequate bracing of the walls. Where does it say in there that it was the architect's obligation to direct the bracing of the walls during the course of construction?
See, right below that.
Thank you.
Based on, I can read it, but if it's based on the review of the above, including that would be his calculations and the actual work that he did to come to this opinion, it was the responsibility of both Mr. Solner and Mr. Corkle. Additionally, Mr. Buttry also had a conversation with Mr. Solner regarding this before he even did the affidavit.
I see the truss in the wall connection. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
In the sidewall. That's equivalent to bracing the sidewall.
Bracing the walls. You see, people.
There's truss in the wall connection, but I'm just trying to get clear what this affidavit is saying.
Right. It is talking about bracing of the walls under B. It says the collapse of the trusses was inadequate bracing of the wall.
Got it, but you're telling me, and I asked you then, where does it say in this affidavit that it was Mr. Solner's obligation to direct the bracing of the walls during the construction of the trusses, and you refer me to C, but I'm having trouble lining those two paragraphs up.
Okay. I can say nothing other than it was his opinion that based on the review of the standards and on the review of Solner's affidavits to detail this truss wall connection, because the trusses sit on these walls.
I understand. That much I know.
So what we also have is the dealing with the issue of superior knowledge and foreseeability.
But there are a lot of things that sit on one another in the course of building any kind of building, and the architect isn't responsible for the placement of all those pieces.
As we've indicated in the briefing, TPI 85, which was actually the law of Wisconsin at the time this is written, puts direct responsibility on the building designer to detail these the connection of the trusses to the other bit.
Your folks didn't read that, right? They didn't even read the TPI, so what's the difference whether he did or he didn't? They wouldn't have known, right?
Well, actually, it's important because it's something that Mr. Solner would have realized as part of his obligation. Reading TPI, the brochure that my clients would have received when they put it up, would not have prevented this incident because TPI addresses the bracing of.
Right, and it wouldn't have helped why this building collapsed. It collapsed because the walls were not braced properly. I got that. My problem is trying to figure out what the scope of Mr. Solner's duty is according to your theory. Okay? And I can see what you're saying, that the walls weren't braced, so that's why the building came down. When you put the trusses on top, the walls are already constructed. What I don't see in the affidavit is an allegation by your expert that it was the architect's duty to supervise the bracing of those walls during the placing of the trusses. That's where I'm having problems.
Well, I don't believe it says that because we don't believe it was a duty of supervision. This was not necessarily strictly a construction site supervision. This was an anomaly. The size of these trusses placed them outside of TPI, forced enormous pressure on the sidewalls, which would have been beyond the competence of these ordinary construction workers or even their employer to understand the forces involved. So this is all about Alvarado. When we get to the point of
Alvarado was a premises liability case. Let's just talk about what we're doing with this case.
Okay.
I'm trying to understand what you think the scope of his duty is. Can you just answer me what is the scope of his duty in regard to bracing the walls, which was, as you allege, the cause of the collapse?
His duty was to make sure that they were adequately braced. We deal with this in our brief, and it's under TPI 85, number 7, to the appendix of that, which says, what was he supposed to do? Well, there is an obligation because, and I respectfully want to raise this Alvarado issue because it is important, because it has to do with common law duties of foreseeability. See, when there is foreseeability, who would these forces have been foreseeable to? They would have been foreseeable, according to my expert's testimony, they would have been foreseeable to the truss designer, the truss manufacturer, which was Corbelec, and they would have been foreseeable to the architect, because in Mr. Solner's affidavit, he indicates that he made sure that the trusses that were cooperatively designed between he and Corbelec fit for pitch, and pitch is what takes this outside of TPI. So this is relevant, because if you give people instructions and bury them in the standard contract sort of documents that come with the trusses, and they've been putting up trusses for years and don't realize that this is out of the ordinary, which is what the Vanessa case has as an exception, is that where this is beyond what they would have anticipated being a problem or a danger to them, then it becomes incumbent, based on Wisconsin law, the Vanessa case, that the architect steps in and at least provides a warning. Then we're talking about something as simple as a phone call. We're talking about, listen, these are going to call for something extra. Additionally,
if he didn't have the obligation to supervise when these trusses were going to go up, how would we know how the construction company decided to use his workers to place them?
Actually,
he didn't have to be there when the trusses were put on.
But actually, what he is required is to give them a framing plan. Under TPI 85, no framing plan was ever
submitted. You tell me this is outside of TPI 85, and you're telling me I should look to it for a
No, problem. Actually, TPI is telling you, and whoever's looking at it, what is outside its own scope. And then it places, if this is outside our scope, TPI will tell you how to do the process. But it also says, if it's outside our scope, the building designer has to take responsibility for this. And that's clear. So he didn't need a framing plan. It would have given him a framing plan that would show what to do with these sidewalks, but it never happened. And only he and Corbelec, according to our expert's testimony, only he and Corbelec had the knowledge necessary to know what risks that these people were taking, because it's not common sense that is the issue. So it's not about common sense, because the forces grow dramatically depending on what happens with the pitch. And the pitch actually placed these outside of TPI as well, and that's in the record. What we have also, though, are clarifications necessary because of the trial court's acceptance of lawyer opinions. In the second hearing, that it became necessary to file the second and third affidavits on our motion for reconsideration. Now, we believe that the first one should have been enough because under Dean Medical versus Fry, if the only thing called for is an expert opinion, and the expert opinion is given, then therefore it has established a fact, which must go back on summary judgment. We're not asking this court to decide this case in the sense of the ultimate merits. What we are saying is that there are genuine issues of material fact with respect to what was done, who did it, and who should be responsible, and foreseeability is clearly at issue here. In fact, that's what held the Court of Appeals back in deciding this case originally was Alvarado. And the language from Alvarado is quite clear. But this is an issue of an omission, okay? Where there's an omission that a party reasonably foresees will, and the omission was not giving him a framing plan, not giving them a warning that this isn't normal, and it wasn't normal. So we've reached beyond the scope of these other architectural cases like the NASA where there was testimony that this was all normal. But there hasn't been any new expert testimony from the defense in this case since we won the first motion for summary judgment. None. So the only testimony in this case on cost comes from our expert. And the cost is something that follows outside of TPI. But if that's the case, then the issue goes to, well, what was this foreseeable? And if TPI says that certain things are the responsibility of the building designer, then that's unquestionably so there.
Mr. Stamba, and maybe I missed something here, but didn't the trial court at the second hearing and the Court of Appeals in its decision indicate that in looking at what had been presented on the summary judgment motion, that there was a problem? problem was that there was testimony in regard to the duty of an architect, and that what you presented was a testimony from an engineer that did not provide the kind of expert contrary evidence that should have been there in regard to the duty of an architect. How do you get around that? Why is Mr. Oquatri's affidavit sufficient to allow him to get around that problem?
Because he is a structural engineer, and under the Wisconsin Administrative Code, a building designer can be a structural engineer or it can be an architect. Under the case I cited before and was cited in our brief, as well as several other foreign jurisdiction cases, structural engineers have been allowed to testify in cases where there was a claim that the architect was negligent, because it's an area of overlapping knowledge, okay? That is clear. What we look at is not the title, is this person an architect or is this person not? The question is this person capable of testifying as a structural engineer with respect to what occurred? And we're not talking about the architect's professional duty so much. We're talking about a common law duty here. This originated between Corpola and Solar. The design of the trusses themselves placed this enormous amount of force on these sidewalls. So it became necessary, and I'm sorry I've run out of time, but if I can finish.
Sure, the chief would let you finish your answer.
Okay. What we have here is an area of overlapping knowledge. And Wisconsin law has held, I think it was in the case I cited in the state, in Roberts versus State. Okay. In that case, it's not the title we're looking for, it's the knowledge we're looking for. And also in these other cases where we've talked about architectural malpractice or just architectural negligence, these were structural engineers who are testifying in the Consulab case for the defense of the Vanessa case. In that case, it's all structural engineers talking about, well, what happened and why did this happen and who the responsibility was. But who is being sued in that case? It's the architect who's being sued in that case. Wisconsin has allowed this for many years for structural engineers to do this because they're both, along with the architect, building designers. So that is our argument with respect to that, because it is the issue.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice, Justices. As you know, my name is Lynn Loffenberg, and I do appreciate the opportunity to participate in oral argument here today on behalf of the Wisconsin Academy of Trial Lawyers on the issue of the application of Section 809.25, Sub 3, to this case, and specifically the issue raised by the petition for review by Solner, and that is whether the Court of Appeals has correctly interpreted that section in holding that sanctions may not be imposed for frivolous appeal unless it determines that all arguments made by a party in support of its position on appeal are frivolous. For the reasons we've stated in some detail in the amicus brief, it is the Academy's position, and I hope to highlight those either in response to your questions or if I have time, but the Academy believes that the Court of Appeals has correctly, by longstanding interpretation, applied the statute because it is consistent with both the plain language of the statute, which says the appeal, in contrast to the trial court standards, which allow assessment of frivolous claim sanctions for individual arguments, individual pleadings, individual positions. And secondly, it's also consistent with the oft-stated policy of this court not to permit the use of frivolous sanctions, frivolous appeal sanctions, or frivolous claim sanctions to have a chilling effect on both counsel's encouragement to make arguments for advancement of the law, and secondly, on counsel's duty to zealously advocate for his or her client. However, in keeping with a fundamental principle, which in fact Mr. Solner cites in his response to the Academy's brief, that this court should only decide issues of policy in interpretation of Section 809.25, sub 3 is an issue of policy. When that issue is squarely before it, we do not believe that the court should and needs to address and decide the issue raised by Solar in his petition in this case, and I say that for two reasons. First, and I'll elaborate on this in a minute, I do not think, and the Academy does not believe, that there was a basis for finding any of the arguments made in the Court of Appeals to be frivolous. Secondly, and probably most importantly, as I understand the position of Solar in this court, it is that if the determinative issue is found to be frivolous, then there should be an ability to impose sanctions on the appellant for having pursued the appeal. In fact, the determinative issue in this case was not found to be frivolous. Solner's position is that the issue of causation was determined to be frivolous. That is not supported by a reading of the decision, as acknowledged by Solner in both his petition and all of his briefing in this case. For example, in the petition at page 11, the court, Mr. Solner states, in the majority decision on the frivolousness issue, that's the decision by Judges Bergeron and the court found that on the professional duty analysis or element, the appellants had made a sufficient showing to escape a finding of frivolousness. But then Solner goes on to say, presumably, all three judges found the arguments on breach of duty and causation to be frivolous. He says presumably because if you read the concurrence, which becomes the majority on the frivolousness issue, neither judges Bergeron and Deininger don't even address the issue of causation as to whether it is or is not frivolous. The same statement is
offered. Yes. Interrupt for a minute. My understanding is that opposing counsel relies on Jandert and says that this situation is somewhat akin to Jandert, and therefore we should apply what we did in Jandert to this situation. What's your response to that?
I'm not sure in what way opposing counsel is relying upon Jandert.
He found it like it had to do with his causation issue, as I read the briefs.
I didn't see that developed in Mr. Solner's brief, so it's hard for me to comment, except to say that the Jandert case involved the imposition of sanctions by a trial court under 814.025 and 802.05, which are the standards which the court knows the trial court has to apply. It did not involve the application of 809.23 sub 5, which is the appellate frivolous claim statute. In addition, significant in the Jandert case, there wasn't really a dispute on the merits of the case any longer by the time the issue of sanctions came about, because the plaintiff had voluntarily dismissed his claim. And at that point, the only issue was that claim frivolously brought or frivolously maintained? And there were findings made by the trial judge on those issues. In this case, there has never been a finding that counsel for the Baumeister and Brown ever frivolously brought or maintained the action. There was a passing comment by the trial judge that he thought there was a problem concerning Jandert, but he expressly if you read the transcript of the trial judge's decision at page 55, he expressly states, I'm taking this issue under advisement. So he did not make findings, and Solner concedes that point. Further, the Court of Appeals didn't make those findings either. So Jandert really has no relationship to the issue raised in this case because it doesn't involve 809.25 sub 3. Proceeding with the point I was making is that not only did Solner concede in his petition that there had been no express finding of frivolousness with regard to the causation issue, in his the matter is, the dispositive issue in the Court of Appeals was not causation. The dispositive issue by the Court of Appeals was the question of duty. Because if you get to page paragraph 29, after discussion of duty, that is where the court, Judge Ludston, states, we could stop here. Because he's already disposed of the issue of duty in the context of this appeal. And then goes on to discuss other issues, including at paragraph 32, that Beimeister and Brown have a causation problem.
Okay. As I read the Deininger concurrence, joined in by Judge Bergeron, they took the position that they would, unless all the arguments were frivolous on an appeal, they would not call the appeal frivolous. And their position was that there was at least one argument that wasn't frivolous. Namely, as you say, duty, I would say breach of the standard of
right.
Therefore, since that is one of the elements of liability, and it was not frivolous, even though it's a loser, apparently, at that stage, then it won't give frivolous costs. Now, let us, for the moment, accept that the standard of care was not frivolous. It arguably has merit. That still raises the causation issue. Just for the moment, let us assume causation was, and it's quite obvious that it's frivolous to argue that any breach of care by Solmar, even if we accept he breached his duty, would be a causation for the damage here. And that, Lundstrom says in paragraph 32, and it's a one-liner, since Baumeister and Brown didn't follow the trust plate guidelines, they can't show that a director found in Solmar. The guidelines we found was a substantial factor. Okay, so let's say that that causation is frivolous. Can't show it if we, negligence fails, liability fails. Should we now impose costs as a frivolous action?
With respect, Justice Abramson, you identified several hypothetical ifs that I do not believe are met by the facts of this case. This court certainly does have the ability to independently examine arguments and determine independently whether there is a frivolous argument having been made. I don't think that is true. Certainly not in this court. I might say, I might point out in our briefs, I see my time is up. Shall I finish? In our briefs, I suggest to the court, and this is documented, this is supported several times by reading Judge Lunston's decision, that the primary problem Judge Lunston has is that the briefing wasn't really very good. He very many times cites to the lack of cogent argument, the lack of citation to the record, the lack of supporting an argument with accurate citation to law, and we suggest that there should not be an equation with an inadequate marshalling of facts and law with a finding of frivolousness. I think those problems have been remedied by the briefing in this court. But getting back to your question, Justice Abramson, the if that the causation issue is frivolous cannot be sustained here based upon the merits that have been, even however the court decides the merits of that argument, it's a meritorious argument.
Right, let's just take my assumption that it was frivolous. I'm making it up. I'm not minding you. I'm not minding Mr. Stumbo what it was. Let us assume that the causation issue element is frivolous. What's your position?
Assuming that it was frivolous is not the same as the Court of Appeals making a finding that it is frivolous. It could be that the court is asking if the justices here find it's frivolous. All right.
You want to answer it that way? That's fine with me.
That's fine. I think that there is a rational argument that the statute could be applied to say that the appeal is frivolous under those circumstances, that hypothetical. I want to emphasize that the Academy does believe that the court ought to have authority to sanction truly frivolous appeals. And if the determinative issue, however that is determined, although it's very difficult, as I say, in a multi-issue case like this for counsel to anticipate what's going to be the determinative issue on appeal. But if that is the determinative issue, and it wasn't established that that was the determinative issue here, then I think that the court should have the authority to exercise power under the statute to impose sanctions. But as I said, there are just too many ifs to get to that point in the context of this case.
I want to bring you back a little bit more into where I think the chief is going. We have a claim of negligence. You have to prove certain elements. Essentially, what she's asking you is if you fail on one element, then that element, there's no proof. It's simply frivolous to try to prove it. It doesn't matter how meritorious all the other elements of the claim might have been argued, because you've got to have that one element. And I guess I'd like to know from you is if one element of a claim, here we have negligence, cannot be shown by any good faith argument, is the appeal frivolous?
I think it's very difficult to apply that rule in a bright line fashion because you have to consider the circumstances of the case in which that issue clearly arrives.
You cannot have a negligence claim without proving all the elements, Counselor. What's ambiguous about that?
I accept the concept, Your Honor, Justice Abrams Wagensack, but the problem with that is counsel has a duty to his client to zealously advocate all of the elements in the case.
I actually agree with you. I don't have a problem with that. But what I'm asking you is if there is one element, and you have to give me that part of the hypothetical, and I know you don't find that hypothetical consistent with the facts, and I respect that. If there's one element of a claim on which there is no proof, so asserting that element is frivolous, isn't the appeal frivolous?
Yes.
Okay.
I think I said that to Justice Abramson, but I was concerned that it takes it out of the context of this case.
Yeah, we're not trying to.
Yeah, I understand the context here, depending on what the how negligence was proved and what aspect of negligence was proved, that would affect causation.
Yes.
Therefore, once you got a valid, that is non-frivolous discussion on negligence, then it would be very difficult to argue that causation was frivolous because you didn't know how it was going to come out as to what was the standard of care, what was the breach, etc. And of course, once the court decided that, then the causation fell into line, but you wouldn't know that ahead of it. That's how I understood your answer.
That's correct, and you expressed it much better than I did, Justice Abramson. Thank you very much.
Chief. Also, please.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. I'm Anthony Horn. I'm representing architect Edward Solner in this matter. I think I just heard my opposing counsel admit that every argument doesn't have to be frivolous if a key element is frivolous. That is, if causation is frivolous, and the whole lawsuit was frivolous in the trial court because of lack causation, the only argument was frivolous. And it goes to the Court of Appeal on a number of interesting arguments, none of which are frivolous, but the case is still frivolous. And the appeal is frivolous. You can never win. All those interesting arguments, you can win every one of them, but as long as causation is still frivolous, and the entire case, the underlying action is frivolous, why are we there? We shouldn't be in the Court of Appeals.
Part of that was the whole point of the communication between Mr. Loffenberg, Justice Robinson, and myself.
I agree, Your Honor, and I'm glad to hear that the opposing counsel is now concurred.
The problem is that whether or not you're accurately stating what the opposing counsel said, we don't have to debate that. We can listen to the tape, which I hope is being accurately made.
Well, let's go back to the beginning. This is a suit that should have never happened. It was an appeal in the Court of Appeals that should never have happened. It was a petition to this court by Ed Solner that was necessitated by the accumulation of mistaken policy decisions by our Court of Appeals over the years. We need to straighten this out, and I'm mindful of the fact that a majority of this bench has already voted through, in theory, repeal 814.025 as it stands today, which is the basis for 809.25, both of which which are statutes enacted by the legislature, and also to repeal sections of 802.05 as they stand today, those sections having been enacted by the legislature in 1987, those were the 1983 amendments to Rule 11 that our legislature adopted in 802.05. However,
it's clear what you're referring to now, as I understand it, is a petition that's still pending before this court involving a joint petition brought by Waddell, by civil trial counsel, and by the state bar of Wisconsin.
Yes, that's petition 0306. However, today, the law is still the prior law as it stands, and I will be arguing the intent of the legislature with respect to that law.
And let's go forward. Since the court has also worked in this area.
Let me first go to the merits here, because I'm going to encourage you to put your clerks on citation alert and to go back and actually read the record for a variety of citations you've had here, because I think they're not quite accurately represented. What happened here is we had a motion for summary judgment, and the judge admitted later they didn't read it closely enough. Judge Galloway apologized for not reading it closely enough when he later granted summary judgment. He said, okay, now I get it. And he granted summary judgment. What was in the record? All they had was an affidavit from Engineer Buttery saying to a reasonable degree of engineering certainty, and as preface, the whole affidavit is in engineering terms, Solner should have known better. Well, Solner's not an engineer. Where is the duty for the architect? And what happened here was, even though Buttery might have been able to testify against Solner had he been qualified, had he said this is an area of overlap, he never said that. He never got qualified. Nothing in his resume indicated that he knew anything about architectural professional standards or that this was an area of overlap. Indeed, they call him a structural engineer, but if you read his resume, he's a structural engineer in concrete, not trusses. In any event, he provided that one affidavit. The other two affidavits referred to here today were never admitted by the trial court. The trial court, in its discretion, refused to admit them. There has never been an appeal of the trial court's decision not to admit those other two affidavits. They aren't part of this record. And yet, opposing counsel just continues on and on and on, referring to them, failing to mention the trial court disallowed them.
Counselor, I want to shift your focus a little bit. I want you to tell me what you think Architect Solner's duty was with regard to the placing of the trusses on the completed sidewalks.
Architect Solner did not have a duty to do anything but inspect the completed work, that is, the final placement of the trusses and the permanent bracing, to see if they complied with the Wisconsin Building Code.
He had no duty in regard to the actual putting together the building, but he had a duty in regard to inspecting it once it was put together to see if it met the plans and specs.
Yes, the contract between Holy Trinity Church and Architect Solner was the standard AIA form document B-141, section 2.6.6 says explicitly, the architect shall not have control over or charge or shall not be responsible for construction means, methods, technology, sequences, or procedures, or for safety precautions and programs in connection with the work, since these are solely the contractor's responsibility under the contract for construction. There is a parallel contract between the owners and the contractors that says in section 4.2.3, that's contract A101 and 201, that it is solely the contractor's responsibility to determine the methodology of construction. We are not talking about the permanent bracing here. And it's an important distinction. We're talking about temporary bracing. This collapsed during the construction because, allegedly, the temporary bracing that would be used to brace it while construction was underway was not adequate. The architect, there is a provision. Solner could have been made responsible for supervising construction if Holy Trinity Church had hired him. There's another provision in the contract that specifically asked the owner, do you want him to supervise construction? They said no. This is literally, this is the Vanasek case all over again. It's identical. The only difference is the trusses are wood. In Vanasek, they were steel. Same thing. The architect is not the guarantor of site safety. If the contractor does not have sufficient information or does not feel his experience or his abilities are sufficient, then he is to go hire an engineer or an architect to provide him advice. Contractually, he takes on that responsibility. Before you build this building, everybody decides who's going to be responsible for what. And then each of them takes responsibility and does that.
On page SA-47, this is the appendix, which is Solar's affidavit, he said, after the collapse, I reviewed the truss design. Is this the permanent or is this the temporary? I reviewed the truss design with the truss designer representatives of the Forest Products Lab, who suggested and explained that extending the connection over the entire bottom cord would significantly strengthen the cord, which had split in half during the collapse. Subsequent trusses supplied by Automated Products extended the plate over the bottom cord, and that is how they were constructed for replacement of the damaged trusses. So apparently, the original trusses had some problems, and then he said...
No, Your Honor, that is an incorrect conclusion from that statement for two reasons.
And then it says he has no professional opinion as to whether dry rot or the length of the bottom cord bracket had any causal effect on the truss collapse, as I have not re-engineered the trusses and do not precisely know where the dry rot was located.
Okay. Now, the problem with that is, first of all, despite what counsel says, someone who didn't design the trusses. Engineer Corpulet Automated Components designed those trusses. Those trusses are a building component built to Department of Commerce specifications that you will find in the administrative code. The specifications that the Department of Commerce has adopted are the TPI recommendations. That's part of the building code. They certify that as a building component to be used in the building. The architect does not engineer the trusses. All he says is, this is the space. I need something to hold the roof up. It goes off to the contractor then. The contractor, because he's responsible for methods and techniques, hires the truss company that builds trusses for him. And their engineer, using Department of Commerce-approved components, designs the trusses. He delivers them. They deliver them to site. In this case, they deliver with a booklet explaining how to install them. And all Solner does, the only thing Solner does under the building code, and this is undisputed in the affidavits of Solner and Architect Madden, he inspects those trusses to make sure that they fit the design, that is, that they are within the shape of the building that he's doing, not to see whether they're architecturally correct, not to see whether they're strong enough, not to see where the plates are or anything else.
Under 32, under the Wisconsin Administrative Code, I would have been responsible to inspect the final bracing and connections of the trusses to make sure they were properly made in conformance with the code.
At the end, he has to do that. At the end, not during construction. We never got to the end here. It fell down. The temporary bracing may or may not stay as permanent bracing and may be removed. He may never inspect that. First of all, understand the building code does not cover construction of buildings. It covers the completed building. The building code, even though it incorporates PPI 85, it incorporates it for the purposes of design specifications, not with respect to anything said in there about temporary bracing, because the building code doesn't cover the methodology of construction. It only covers the completed project. Now, in this particular case, as said in the transportation insurance case years ago, if you're going to say the architect's responsible here, you've just made the architect the insurer for site safety forever, for everything. That's Solar wasn't even present when this was being done. He wasn't required to be present. His contract didn't require him to be present. He did not inspect or engineer these trusses. The fact that he checked into it afterwards is a natural result of being concerned over the accident. I mean, it is a very unfortunate accident. People were hurt. Why were they hurt? Because their employer failed to use proper safety methodology. Diamond Builders did not follow the TPI instructions. Diamond Builders gave the wrong instructions for their employees. They got the HIV 85 proposal. Had they placed the center support, the permanent solid scaffolding up the middle, these trusses come together in the middle. That requirement requires a solid scaffolding in the middle to support it affirmatively in the middle while you put them together, while you assemble them and connect the seam right at the top. It's being held up by scaffold. What happened here, it's undisputed. They went down and pushed out the walls. Had that center scaffolding been there, you can see it's physically impossible to come down because they're affirmatively held up in the air. You cannot droop in the middle when there's a solid support underneath you. This isn't that difficult. This is basically common sense. And when Attorney Winston was challenged with that in the trial court by Judge Galloway, he had to admit it. I mean, you can't fall down in the middle if it's got a solid beam underneath it. That's what happened here. They didn't put in the center support, which TPI recommends. They followed a methodology of their choosing. Nothing that Ed Solar did or did not do caused Baumeister and Brown to install those trusses the way they did. His failure to give them instructions had nothing to do with it. He wasn't expected to give instructions. They already had instructions from the truss engineer. Follow TPI. That's what we recommend. Diamond Builders, for whatever reason, chose not to. And it's undisputed that the second time it went back to put these same trusses up, well, they had extended the braces a little bit, they put the center beam up, and it didn't fall down.
Was it dry rot?
The dry rot, we don't know what that might have done, if anything. We don't know. But Solar wasn't there to inspect the trusses before they went up. That wasn't what he was supposed to be there for. If there's dry rot, that's a claim against automated components. They're still in a lawsuit. If that is in fact the problem. But Architect Buttery, none of his affidavits, even the ones that weren't admitted, suggest that the trusses themselves were defective in their manufacture. So I don't know where that one's going. We have here, on the merits, just a logical disconnect with anything that Solar did or did not do, because he could not foresee these damages. If you want to put it in the Alvarado context, he would never foresee this happening, because first of all, he wasn't supposed to design this stuff. He wasn't supposed to design the temporary bracing, supervised construction, or do any of this. So to think that his inaction, he could foresee someone being hurt by his inaction, he couldn't foresee that because his contract said he wasn't supposed to do that. There is no evidence here that Solar discovered mistaken construction by the contractor. That Solar discovered that the crew didn't speak English and all the instructions were English and he should have known that they were screwing up. There's nothing like that here. I'll admit there could be a situation where the architect would learn something, voluntarily become involved, or do something that would obligate him to go further than the contract. We don't have any evidence of that here. Didn't happen here. This claim that somehow these trusses were beyond the TPI instructions, that, of course, only came up because this is a constantly moving target, as the Court of Appeals said. That wasn't raised in the trial court. That wasn't argued in the trial court. It's something we got on appeal. We're dealing with it now, but we don't have the record to deal with it because it wasn't raised in a timely fashion in the trial court. But that's nonsense. The TPI instructions were followed the second time, and it didn't fall down, and they were essentially the same trusses. We have the quote. And this is interesting because Mr. Baumeister's brother was the supervisor who gave him the wrong instructions. And his brother was deposed in this lawsuit before Solner was joined. Before Solner was joined, when it was a different lawsuit, he testified and he said that they went back and they assembled him the second time. And on the second time, all they did was they extended. Question, when you put them up the second time, did you brace them differently? Answer, not much. We put a little more bracing, but we put scaffolding underneath them in the middle to support more weight in the middle until we were completely done. That's in the record at entry 25. That was in the record before they sued Solner. They already knew that, and they sued him anyway. They sued Solner without bothering to get the contracts. They had discovery opportunities. They could have done discovery. They didn't bother getting the contract from Holy Trinity. They didn't bother getting the contractor's contract. They had no idea what he had been hired to do or not do.
Mr. Carter, if you are successful on your frivolous argument, what can this court do? I mean, you're now making arguments they didn't do this, they didn't do that. What kind of factual basis and record do we have? And what can the Court of Appeals do?
That's the problem here, and that's one of the things I'd like you to correct. Leskey. The Leskey case allowed appeals before sanctions were resolved. And what happens is we end up here without a whole record.
Well, here's the problem with that argument. You make it in your brief, as I see it. It's possible, I think, and maybe you disagree, that you can have a non-frivolous trial. There's a non-frivolous complaint, non-frivolous answer, discovery, etc. And let the appeal be frivolous.
Absolutely. In fact, I believe we had one of those on a pro se case where it was frivolous on appeal because all they were trying to do was reverse the factual findings of the trial court, and that was just frivolous.
Okay. Therefore, your argument that the problem arises because there weren't findings at the trial court doesn't hold water because you're going to have cases where there aren't going to be findings at the trial court because it's out of the jurisdiction of the trial court once that appeal. For most things, it's out of the jurisdiction of the trial court. Once the appeal is filed, now the claim is not that it was frivolous in the trial court, but that it's a frivolous appeal. You still have the problem of an appellate court making findings.
Yes, but let's step back. Let's step back one. When it is frivolous in the trial court, the job for the Court of Appeals is much simpler. First of all, under Riley versus Isaacson, you know it's automatic. 805, finding in the trial court, it's automatic fees on appeal. The Court of Appeals doesn't have to deal with it.
Well, unless the trial court was wrong.
Yeah, I'm assuming that there is an affirmation on appeal. Then the Court of Appeals doesn't have to go forward. See, one of the problems now is Leskey allows these interim appeals. And I see it particularly in the Glaske versus Shaw case. That case is now in its second year, second appeal, because we didn't get it done in the trial court. And it would have been done in 90 days. The judge had already had the hearing. He was going to render his decision. The appeal was taken. No decision. That also means no judgment, no interest, and nothing for the Court of Appeals to look at. It also means...
Isn't it possible when you're at the Court of Appeals and you have that kind of a loose string hanging out, ask the Court of Appeals to remand the case back to the trial court or to...
We did.
...up that decision?
The Court of Appeals in Glaske decided. We asked them to send it back to the trial court with an open mandate such that if the trial court found that the case violated 802.05, which would make for automatic fees on appeal, that it would find that on that appeal we were entitled to attorney's fees. The Court of Appeals said no appeals will be awarded on that even if there's a later finding on 802.05. So the timing decided whether an award of fees was made or not, and the timing was in the sole control of the attorney found frivolous. He had the timing. He could do it. He could avoid fees on appeal by just getting the appeal in. They would not be awarded on that appeal unless every argument on that appeal was frivolous, even though when he came back down, he got nailed on 80205. Same issue. Timing was everything. But it's also thousands of dollars to the victims of a frivolous lawsuit. If they are victims of a frivolous lawsuit, it costs them money. They are damaged every bit as much as the chicken farmer who loses his chickens. It only costs you money. You can buy new chickens. Mr. Sommer looking at $50,000 in legal fees for a lawsuit that should have never happened. The question before this court is, does the victim of a frivolous lawsuit have to pay that? Or should the perpetrator of a frivolous lawsuit pay that?
It's so frivolous, how come the fees are so high?
Because they have fought and fought and fought because they're not spending money. It's free time to them. They changed the argument at every step of the way. It had to be responded to. We had three motions for reconsideration. We had motions to amend the record in the Court of Appeals. We have had three briefs in this court for us. We had two briefs down below. We also had the petition. It adds up. And even though it's frivolous and it should be obvious, we have to respond to everything they do. And we had to respond to Waddle. I mean, there are some serious policy issues raised by this case, even though it's frivolous.
It seems to me that aside from jurisdictional issues, you're making a very good argument why the frivolous statutes should be changed.
Well, Your Honor, the legislature made a decision on this one.
Let's leave out that argument.
Legislative or
judicial?
Follows from the American rule. Our American rule works very well when both sides have a good argument, and neither one knows who's going to win, and they compromise. But the American rule doesn't work when one side has nothing but a frivolous case and is holding up the other, hopefully for a settlement, because it's going to cost more to litigate. This lawsuit started as a suit against Ed Solder and ABC Insurance Company, and the only question I ever got from the other side was, who's his insurance company? Well, Ed didn't have an insurance company for a variety of reasons at that point in time. He stuck with it. And no discovery. The only discovery was what we initiated. No discovery. We were on the eve of trial when summary judgment was granted. They were going to go to trial with Buttery and nothing else. They didn't even have an architect. They couldn't find an architect to say that there was something wrong with what Solder had done. We had two architects, Solder and Lee Madden, AIA architects licensed in the state of Wisconsin, saying, you got this all wrong. This isn't the way it works. Undisputed on an architectural standard.
You know, one of the things I have a real problem with in frivolous is on Ash Longston's decision. Page SA-17, he says, would a reasonable attorney have known the appellate arguments based on Buttery affidavits are frivolous? And he says, I conclude that attorneys for Baumeister Brown should have known they were frivolous because they were repeatedly advised of the issue by you during the circuit court's proceedings. So he says, look, you told them they should have recognized it. Page SA-19 says, similarly, the opinion of Solder's attorney regarding the chance of a favorite summary judgment is irrelevant. He's not going to rely on your opinion.
I should explain that to you.
It's substantive. It just seems to me so inconsistent.
No, you're taking both out of context. Have you read the letter that I said that I'm unlikely to get a favorable decision on remand? Have you read that letter?
Yeah.
I'm being sarcastic about the likelihood of any motion for reconsideration. He already didn't read the paperwork the first time. I love Judge Calloway, but I didn't think he was going to read it the second time. That's all that was about. However, what Judge Lindstrom is pointing out is this isn't a mistake. If he had made a mistake and corrected it, Lindstrom was not going to find him frivolous. Okay, he brought the lawsuit. He didn't check out his case law to start with. He would have known about Bonasek. He would have known about the Hunsinger construction case. And by the way, I found out that after we briefed, that the Construction Law Journal annotated this case in January of 2004 at pages 3 through 5. Citing all the other cases around the country that agree with our Court of Appeals from cases from Georgia, Colorado, Illinois, Ohio, all on the same AI standard. Now, Judge Lundstrom. I'm not sure that that's BMA. It's an instruction law reporter.
Okay, thank you.
And you'll find a number of other cases there. And they're in conformity with Vonisek and Munsinger. But what he's saying there is, okay, it wasn't a simple mistake. These guys were warned. They got all the information they needed to realize they made a mistake. They could have backed off. They didn't have to appeal this thing. They did it anyways. And at this point, they should know better. I'm just not going to cut them any slack. That's the way I do that comment from court. Now, with respect to whether the Court of Appeals found causation to be frivolous, read it again. What they have there is, first of all, Lundstrom found it frivolous. He said everything was frivolous. Dinenger and Bertrand start out their concurrence by saying, we agree with everything he said, except we don't find duty frivolous. It's arguable, not close. But that's not frivolous. Now, the conclusion I draw from that is they still found causation frivolous. And on this record, it is frivolous. Solar was not obligated to provide these documents. He didn't provide the instructions. The engineer submitted the TPI instructions and recommended them. Diamond Builders picked a whole different way of doing it, and that whole different way caused the injury. Solar is twice removed, and this was never in dispute. This was in the record before they even sued us. They should have known better. I'm sorry, Your Honor, but from my vantage point, I'm less charitable than the court on this one. I think this was a sue everybody in sight, look for the deep pockets. I hope there's an insurance company that will pay us off. Type litigation. Because after they found out there was no insurance company and they were just dealing with that solar, discovery didn't happen. We were really arguing about whether the case was frivolous or not, which was raised at the first pretrial conference. What happened here was their motions for reconsideration were filed after I filed a motion for frivolousness. And you're right, Your Honor, you're right that the frivolous action statutes does cause litigation once litigation has commenced that was frivolous. The frivolous action statute, however, is a strong repellent of initially filing frivolous litigation. And our legislature has decided that those who are damaged by frivolous litigation, those individuals like Ed Solner, who's got $50,000 in damages, are to be compensated, made whole. That's the Isaac versus Riley versus Isaacson discussion. To be made whole. Why? Because as a form of penalty to stop frivolous lawsuits, because the American rule doesn't work with frivolous lawsuits. Unfortunately, once the frivolous lawsuit is started, notwithstanding everything, the lawyer on the other side is working for free, trying to avoid getting tabbed. It runs up a big bill.
Counsel, it seems to me fundamental to your argument of frivolousness is that Buttrey's affidavit opining on the cause and the standard of care so has no merit because he's an engineer, not an architect. Am I right or wrong on that?
That is part of it. He did not. He was never qualified. And they didn't even attempt to qualify him to provide evidence. They could have gotten an architect.
Help me with, get me a response to this. I look at the administrative 50.10 on supervision. It says, with regard to construction or installation, an architect or engineer may supervise the installation of the normal stuff. But, I think of as a former attorney engaged in litigation, you don't always have to, in this kind of a building kind of case, you don't have to have, I don't think,
was an expert on what the engineer did or vice versa.
Some things are common sense, some you know.
Well, that means it's common sense. You don't need an expert at all.
Right.
But, I mean, these engineers know more than I do about
it. Here's our problem with Buttery. Maybe they could have qualified him on two grounds. First of all, he could have said, this is an area of overlap. He didn't. And, you know, it's not an area of overlap. What the professional duties, what's expected professionally from an architect automatically is an architectural duty. And we've seen in the contracts how the architects define their duty. He could have also said, I've worked with architects, I'm familiar with architects, I'm experienced with the AIA contracts, I know this, this, and this. It qualified him to testify on that basis. They didn't do that either. There is a reason why all they could get was a concrete engineering professor from the University of Platteville to do this with all the architects we have in the state. Now, the architectural standard is the architect does not design the temporary bracing for the contractor unless the contractor hires him to do so. That's what architect. So the architect would never have thought that he was supposed to do this.
But my comments go this way, that, you know, in terms of the merits, I'm listening as a trier of fact, and I discount, you know, you're not an architect, and what do you know about it? But in terms of the affidavit and the sufficiency of an affidavit, just which says, I have an opinion that a cause was, you know, and I have an opinion that it's responsibility of Solner, and that, you know, I've done this and I've done that, and I'm a professional engineer for 32 years. That's enough to open the door.
Well, it might be. If you said, and I believe to an architectural standard, he was supposed to, but he didn't even do that. He specifically in this affidavit said to a reasonable degree of engineering, you know, standard. He never crossed over. And that was the main problem. Now, despite my skepticism of Professor Buttery on a number of other grounds, this particular affidavit never crossed over, got that far. That's why the Court of Appeals unanimously said it didn't make it. That's why the trial judge ignored it. It didn't get there. And he may have had maybe he could have said it, I don't know. I think he'd say just about anything, but that was my opinion. In closing, since I've been held over, I just want to point out, first, as I said, nothing Solner did or didn't do caused them to construct this way. So causation is frivolous. It's not even close, it's too removed. Second, if the underlying case is frivolous, there's no point to the appeal. There's no purpose to the appeal. Yes, there can be frivolous appeals on cases that weren't frivolous below, but I think you have to make it clear that not every argument has to be frivolous on appeal when, in fact, the overall case has been frivolous since the day it was filed. Third, you need to reverse Leskie. You need to get a final order out of the trial court that gets all of this stuff done, because it's running cases out to two appeals and 2 years of litigation extra. Instead of letting the trial court get it done, the trial court, if it does in fact make findings, there may be a settlement. There may be no appeal. It may be the guy gets turned down on his frivolous case and the factual findings of the trial court, being subject to deference on appeal, eliminate any appeal whatsoever. We need to change that. The Leskie case drew on ACLU versus Thompson.
You were appellate counsel.
No, I wasn't. But in ACLU, I was in Leskie. I was in Leskie. ACLU versus Thompson dealt with a civil rights cause of action. In civil rights cases, the award of attorney fees to the winning plaintiff is routine and automatic. It is an accounting function. The award of sanctions is a heavily disputed substantive issue. It is not an accounting function. I think the Court of Appeals made a mistake in drawing on ACLU and bringing that in. I mean, I think it's causing all sorts of problems. Caused problems in this case. It caused problems for Waddle because they don't have a hearing to start with. I think we need to change that and get it completed in the trial court before it comes up. This is purely a policy question. It has nothing to do with the frivolousness or non-frivolousness of this case. I think it would save everybody's time. The reasons the Court of Appeals rule must be the way it did were assumptions that, frankly, had been proven to be incorrect. We at the bar are just too imaginative to allow those assumptions to sit, and they didn't. So we need to correct Lesby. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. It's just done well.
Your Honors, this may be one of those cases where they lie well and we speak the truth badly. To bring in from outside the record the amount of the attorney's fees, to bring in DNA stuff that wasn't in the record. This case, you must look at the record on, because defense counsel is attempting, in this case, to buffalo you like he's buffaloed the trial court into believing his expert testimony when there is no expert testimony to support these things. There's never been expert testimony from his side on the cause. There's never been expert testimony from his side on cause. But what we have under TPI is that truss bracing and connection details should be shown in the building designer's framing plan. There was no framing plan. The building designer will specify sufficient bracing and connections to withstand lateral loading of the entire structure, the walls. It didn't happen. That is an omission. And because they didn't have this information, it came down. To say there's no cause here, it is unbelievable. But also to say that he didn't design or didn't have a hand in the design here is unbelievable. I'll refer you to Solner's own affidavit, paragraph 18. During the course of construction, I do verify for design only that the trusses selected and or engineered by the truss manufacturer meet the design criteria. Whose criteria? His criteria. For slope, load, shape, etc. 16. It meets design specification for load and pitch. Well, guess what? Mr. Solner has just said you follow TPI, but we have evidence in this case from the affidavit submitted, including the trial court arguments that the pitch fell outside TPI. So specifying TPI is not going to help you because the issue was the pitch. But to say that we raised this whole pitch issue and that this fell outside of TPI in the Court of Appeals is also incorrect. Mr. Winston, on page 10 of 121, the top court pitch of 5.12 and the trusses in question were 60 feet, with the top court pitch of 10.12. So, in fact, due to the pitch of it, it places it outside the realm of TPI. This is not frivolous. This is bread and butter litigation. The fact that we can't try our whole case on affidavits shouldn't prevent the factual findings. And to say that Buttrey is not qualified, and we didn't properly qualify him, we're responding to a motion for summary judgment. We raised an opinion of an expert who's qualified. His all of his degrees are in structural engineering. This is not outside of that. And I don't think we should minimize the fact that 1 week before his motion for reconsideration, and after all his briefing is in, Mr. Barty here, he indicates that it would be a fluke if the court actually dismisses Solner as a party in this case.
Counselor, where in the record can I look to find whose obligation it was to put the supports in the middle, the scaffolding under the parts of the truss where the two pieces lay?
Right. That was another misrepresentation of the record of this case that you just heard. Because there is an option to do that under TPI. There is an option. There's also an option to do what they did the first time. And we indicated that. And we, under 12.2 of TPI, it says exactly that was merely one option under TPI. There is no evidence, Your Honors, at all that TPI was followed the second time. There's no evidence that the use of a center scaffolding would have prevented the collapse. And that's the real issue here, isn't it? What is the cause of this collapse, actually? The fact that he convinced my associate said, well, it would have relieved some pressure, that doesn't answer the expert testimony question they don't have.
I'm still trying to get back to duty, which is what bothers me about this whole case. And like I did when I first talked to you, my question to you was, is there any place in the record where I could find out whose duty it was to put scaffolding under that center part? Now, I understand your answer to be, they didn't have to do it that way. They could have done it some other way. And I understand that answer.
Right.
But I guess is there some place in the record where if they didn't choose that method, the method to go
Belgium, it says
at the most, then we're playing Russian roulette, because what they're told is, well, we'll take the IP in the contract itself. And also under the contract, under 895.49, you can't just assign away your tort liability in a building construction contract. But I'm going to get to answer your question. It would have been the people doing the construction, their responsibility to put in center scaffolding if that is the mode they chose. But solar doesn't
even chose. No, who's the they? Is the they builder or is the they solar?
Diamond Builders, here's the problem with that.
So Diamond Builders gets to choose the method, so they get to choose whether they're going to put the center scaffolding in or not, or do some other method.
That's not correct.
Well, I misunderstood your answer.
What I'm saying is that there's the issue here with respect to causation is an issue that this felt outside of TPI originally.
I don't want to talk about causation. I want to figure out what the scope of this guy's duty was with regard to putting these trusses on top of the wall.
With respect to TPI, the evidence in the record is that they followed TPI with respect to the center splice. They could have done it either way. They had no guidance from the architect to tell them which way would have been the safe way. But also, I think there's a presumption in your question, which is really fatally flawed, Your Honor, and that is this. The fatal flaw is would it have mattered? See, we're hearing today, and the trial court heard, that if they just would have done this, it wouldn't have come down. Where does that come from?
It comes from here.
It doesn't come from anything in this record to say that if they even would have put the center's book, put the scaffolding up to brace it, that this would have still come down. Our expert's testimony is that even if they follow TPI, even if they follow TPI according to what TPI requires, it was going to come down. This is not frivolous.
He talked about an affidavit, I think it was a deposition, about one of the people involved in the construction and what they did the second time, because they put the same thing up, the same trusses, and it didn't fall down, right?
Right.
Is that part of the record? Can I find that?
That is part of the record. It's also in the record that they did other things differently, too, with the trusses.
That's fine. I'm happy to read that. Sure. Okay. All right. Thank you. That, I appreciate it.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Well, both to Attorney Stonebow, Wolfenberg, and Sparta for their arguments, and both the substance and the issue of frivolous action. That concludes our hearing on 02-1003, Baumeister versus Automated Products, Inc. The court's in recess until 1:35.